Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome you to The Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He comes on our program once every 2 weeks, and in the intermediate time, we have another guest speaking on many of the issues that are important to many of the things that we deal with in today's society. Alan, again, I'd like to welcome you to our program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
And Alan, as you, from our topic today, the question is America a democratic society? And we can see from much of what we learn in high school and U.S. Government 101 and all the things that you hear as you go through college about what a true democratic society that we have here in the U.S. And what we're going to explore today, when you really look at it, look at, you know, what democracy is all about, you start realizing that what we have here in the U.S. is not truly a democratic society. Now, Alan, what I'd like for you to do is if you could just start out our program today and just explain when we say a democratic society, what are we talking about?
Well, a democratic society is what's articulated in the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights. A lot of people refer to this as a Jeffersonian democracy. So on paper, we have this democracy, but as most people in this country know, there is a vast gap between what's written on pieces of paper in the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights and what people actually get as far as their rights when it comes to real-life situations. You know, in this country today, we have a democracy of sorts, but it's a capitalist democracy where the very richest rule. Wall Street is in firm control of this country, and they're dictating the terms of what democracy will be at this point. Many people refer to this as a plutocracy or an oligarchy, and an oligarchy is a government of the very few. And for all practical purposes, that's what we have, the few wealthy people who own and control the means of production. They're the ones that determine what kind of democracy we have. And, this 1%, they own the printing presses. They own the TV stations. They own the radio stations. People have very little. You know, we have some access to the airwaves, like your program here. We supposedly have the right to go out and pass out leaflets, but anybody that's passed out leaflets against the war or articulated problems that we're having in this country, they find real quick that the police are right there. They want to know what you're passing out. They try and stop you from doing it. Here in Little War Road, Minnesota, where we have a fairly large casino that we're trying to organize, the chief of police, Lawrence Wright, actually threatened to have me arrested for passing out leaflets on a public sidewalk because he maintained that the sidewalks were actually privately owned, and the people that own the sidewalks just let people use the sidewalks as a courtesy to walk on, not to pass out leaflets on. And we had to threaten to sue the city of War Road for several million dollars before they stopped pursuing arrest and everything against us.
Privately owned by whom?
By the homeowners.
The homeowners.
Whoever owned the homes, that they actually owned the sidewalks, and the sidewalks were only for walking on. That's why they were called sidewalks, he said. And there's a sidewalk in front of the casino, and he maintained that the casino owned that sidewalk, so we didn't have the right to pass out leaflets on that sidewalk, that people just had the right to walk on that sidewalk.
So in other words, he was saying there's no public sidewalks.
Essentially, that's what he was arguing, yeah. And the whole city council, they got the city attorney in on this and everything, and they tried to prevent us from passing out leaflets on a public sidewalk. and the only thing the leaflet was about was the terrible situation that people work under in this casino, the low wages, the poverty wages, working in a smoke-filled casino. These were the only things being talked about in the leaflet. So, you know, and they expended all this money and effort, all this police resources to try and stop us from passing out a little leaflet like that. So, you know, that's the true state of democracy in this country. And if we wouldn't have fought that, you know, they could have taken us to jail and fined us and everything else. And we would have had to go through all kinds of expensive court procedures in order to get it overturned. And this is what people face all the time. Workers face this every time they go on strike. They're told that they can't block traffic. You know, they can run scabs through a picket line, but workers aren't supposed to be able to stand in front of the vehicles bringing the scabs in. You know, this goes on all the time in this country.
Right. Now, Alan, in a true democratic society, if we look at what democracy is all about, I mean, you would have to agree that workers should have control of their communities, their neighborhoods. I mean, this is what a democracy should be all about, where people would be able to control their local governments. That's democracy.
Democracy is not just political. We have to talk
right.
about the economics of democracy, too. And that's what, you know, the media and the politicians, they don't want us to talk at all about economic democracy. And a good example, we have a real good example of what's going on in Canada right now and what we'll probably be facing in this country in a couple of years, where the Socialist New Democratic Party is challenging the Liberals and the Conservatives for national power now. And they will probably be taking political power. But the monopolies there in Canada, the bankers, they're still in control. So they'll have to decide if they want to continue to just seize the levers of government or go ahead and take over the mines and mills and factories in Canada. And we're going to be confronting those same kinds of problems here. Because after all, you know, like they closed the St. Paul Ford Twin Cities plant. There was not a single worker that had a say in the decision of whether or not that plant would stay open or be closed. So there is no economic democracy in this country. Working people have no say at all in the economics except for when they fight for increased wages or better benefits against discrimination and everything on the job. It's a real struggle to fight for your rights in this country. And, you know, we have the Bill of Rights, but that means very little. We've seen that all through history in this country. You know, it's supposed to be freedom and democracy. Slaves were not free. The Native Americans had their land stolen out from under them, and they were systematically murdered. You know, this is not democracy. Slaves had no say in the government. Native Americans had no say in the government. In fact, they didn't have a vote until, I think, in the 1950s sometimes.
Women didn't have any say?
Women didn't have any say until the, when was it, in the early 1900s?
Yeah, early 1900s.
Yeah.
During women's suffrage.
Yeah, and people had, women had to fight like heck to get that vote. And
right.
So every
and tell you the truth, Alan, even white males didn't have no say.
No, working people.
Even that's an illusion. The ones that really had a say were still the wealthy elite.
Right. All throughout the history of this country. And that's why, you know, when they talk about democracy, well, you know, we have to talk about what kind of democracy this is. And I think we have to say that this is a capitalist democracy.
Right.
And working people, any rights that working people have, they've had to fight tooth and nail for those rights. Just the
a lot
basic
of what we think about
rights.
As a democracy is all a myth. Ellen, explain to our listeners what a plutocracy is.
Well, a plutocracy is when you have a government by the wealthy, by the wealthiest people, and they control all of society. And essentially, when Wall Street controls everything, that's what we have in this country. And a lot of people don't like to hear that, but this is what we have. When wealth rules, that's what plutocracy is all about. And it becomes an oligarchy when just a few of these very, very wealthy people rule. And that's what we have with Wall Street ruling today. And we saw this back in 1945 when working people tried to get full employment as part of the legislative responsibility of the government. That's when Wall Street really clamped down on working people and said, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And they instituted all kinds of laws to prevent working people from having their rights. You had the Smith Act, the McCarran Act. Finally, they had the Communist Control Act. You know, what kind of democracy would ever have something called the Communist Control Act? And that wasn't just targeting communists. It was targeting anybody with a liberal idea. And we had like 15,000 high school teachers in this country fired in the 1950s. People don't realize that, simply because they were teaching the truth about unions and about civil rights. These people were systematically fired and excluded from teaching in this country. That is not democracy.
Right. Alan, when we look at democracy and we think about during election time, we go to the polls and we elect various representatives that go into state government, local government, state government, and even on the federal level. And in this last election in 2012, it's already estimated that the cost of that election, first of all, it was the most expensive election in the history of the world.
Right.
Most expensive. $5.8 billion just for the presidential campaign for Obama and Mitt Romney. It is estimated that those two campaigns cost more than $1.9 billion, not to mention the monies that were spent on the press and like that.
Does that include super PACs?
Pardon me?
Does that include the super PACs?
No, that didn't include the super PACs. That just include the monies that from those campaigns, monies that were contributed. That's how much money was spent and also contributed to those campaigns. And super PACs, obviously, they spend vast amounts of money on advertising for television, print ads, mailers. I mean, so it's actually, when you look at the total cost, it was close to $6 billion. So when we look at these costs and we talk about a democracy, basically in the U.S., it's not about a democracy because of people putting forth an effort to go out in the streets and promote their campaigns or whatever. But what we're really looking at is Wall Street and the wealthy few. When we look at the wealthy few in our society, they're even taking control of our elections.
Right. If you look at some city council seats in this country, they're spending over $1 million to keep them in some of the larger cities.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's,
it even happens here in Los Angeles, in California, in San Francisco.
Yeah, I think Los Angeles had one of the most expensive city council races. What was it, like $1.5 million or something, or $2 million or something for some city council seat there? But
you remember the last election when Meg Whitman was running for governor here in California. She had already committed right up front. She said, I'm committing up to $150 million for that campaign for governor. She spent close to that exact amount, $150 million. So when you talk about a democracy where people are having people from their communities, people that can relate to the issues that are in their community, you can't compete against Wall Street when they're putting the wealthy people from their communities, people from their corporations, and sending them to Washington and in the state and also the local positions to represent their interests. Then we lose all the connection of what a democracy should be for the people.
Well, I think Malcolm X put it right. I think it was Malcolm X that said, you know, this isn't a democracy, it's a hypocrisy. It's just,
it was,
you know,
Malcolm X.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I think he defined it perfectly, you know. Myself, I've been targeted by the FBI and state police agencies that they have these red squads. Massive files have been assembled on just me as an individual, and you multiply that times hundreds of thousands of other people, and we've got a massive apparatus in this country that their only responsibility in government is to spy on people and to interfere with what people do to try and set things right and create a democracy in this country. If you go out and campaign and talk about that workers had to have the right to stop scabs and that they should have the right to prevent these lockouts, you know, the police will hound you and follow you. They send the police out, these red squads. They'll take pictures of people that come to your home and everything. This is all in the files that we obtained way back in 1974 when the Michigan State Police, when we sued them, and the Michigan Attorney General, Frank Kelly, admitted that they were keeping files, and this is in 1974, on 55,000 people.
55,000 people.
This is just in the state of Michigan. Here in Minnesota, they still have the Red Squads. In Michigan, the Red Squads were ruled unconstitutional by a circuit court judge, Judge Thomas Brown. I was one of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. But the FBI still carries on those kinds of, I don't know if you want to call them responsibilities or duties, whatever they call them, harassing people like this. But here in Minnesota, at the present time, they admit that they're spying on over 80,000 people. You know, these are
80,000 people.
80,000. And, you know, if you, some of the basis that they use for creating a file on a person is if you write a letter to the editor against the war, or if you write a letter to the editor for civil rights, they put
if
your...
If you're a concerned citizen?
Yeah. They clip out these letters and they put them in these files, and all of a sudden you become a subject. You know, they say...
If you write Congress because you have a concern...
Yeah,
they start. They develop a file on you.
Well, one state representative here, he's a Republican. His name is Tony Cornish. He recently sent out an email to thousands of people, saying that he was maintaining a file on me, similar to what the FBI does.
Oh, pathetic.
Yeah, this is the state of our democracy, so-called democracy. And a lot of people, you know, if people don't go out and pass out a leaflet or if they don't write a letter to the editor, they don't notice this repression that's taking place in this country. And this is repression because one of the things that these police agencies do with these files, once they start these files, is they start going to employers and saying, say, you know, we've got a file on this guy or this woman. And then they start showing them the files, and the employer says, well, geez, maybe I shouldn't have them working here. And before you know it, you don't have a job anymore. And this
right.
is the way they operate. They have there's a outfit being funded by Richard Mellon Scaife, a very wealthy individual out of Pennsylvania, I believe he's from. Anyways, he operates, they call it Wiki something, and they literally have thousands of names. You can look up people's names. You can probably look up your name on the Internet and find your name in their file. And what's happened is the FBI has turned over the files to this right-wing organization to put all over on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And they even have the governor of the state of Minnesota. He's in there because, you know, he's talked to me and other people. The Secretary of State, he attended a Communist Party meeting, so he's in there as a friend of the Communist Party. And... you know, this is the extent that they go through. If you read about my name in their files, you'll see that the Communist Party controls the state of Minnesota. You know, if only we did. You
mm-hmm.
know, but this is what's going on again in this country. They've taken McCarthyism to a whole new level, and people don't realize what's going on until they, you know, people will say, well, geez, why did I lose my job? And then you
yeah, we're a lot worse than what we were at that time on the McCarthyism.
Well, yeah, we have a whole new kind of McCarthyism
oh, we
developing
have a,
in the
we have
country.
A new regime here.
Yeah. And, you know, people are going to have to stand up and start fighting for their rights. We're going to have to, you know, one way is more lawsuits. These things should be challenged in the courts, but they should also be challenged in the streets. They should be challenged where we work. You know, if you have friends that are being fired from their jobs because they're participating in peace activities and stuff, we got to organize committees to defend them. You know, there's not even a national committee against political repression in this country anymore. And this is when we really need it. You've got people like Bradley Manning rotting away in jail, and all he did is release some files that should be public in the first place. But, you know, what are these files that he released? They're just documents that embarrass the government because they did so many dirty things to people.
Alan, what I'm gonna, I'd like to just sort of, today we have Alan Mackey. He comes on our program once every 2 weeks and shares a lot of things, not only of interest, but things that we should know in this government that presents a challenge to our freedoms as just working people and citizens. And today we're understanding when we look at what a democracy should be here in the U.S., we do not have a true democracy here in the U.S. We have an illusion that we are free citizens in the society, but trust me, it's only illusion. Alan, what I want to do is look at right now the big money that's in politics, because there's big money. Those people that are representing us, they're in Congress. They're really the functionaries of the big corporations and the richest people in our society, the banks, the oil companies, and when they send lobbyists in. But we're going to look at the politics that is there in Washington. Big money when you look at elected representatives, and many of them, they go there and basically it's just retirement. Once they get there, they're there for a life term. But, Alan, what I'd like for you to do is just share about the way that we have lobbyists, the way they represent big corporations there in Washington, D.C., and how it's not for the interest of working people, but it's for the interest of the people that actually install those individuals there in Congress. Could you share that with our listeners?
Well, the lobbyists are really the secret government in this country. They've written all kinds of legislation and everything. Some 600 lobbyists have actually written the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that the American people aren't even allowed to see. You know, and this is going to be a massive trade agreement that's going to really destroy a lot of jobs and everything. And the American people, you know, you talk about democracy, the American people have no say or no input into this at all. Just some 600 of these big lobbyists have had the say of what will be written into this trade agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're going to move NATO and everything into the Pacific. NATO was designed for the Atlantic region. Now, the Secretary of Defense was over there and said that we're going to move NATO into the Pacific region. Why? Because they know there's going to be resistance to this Trans-Pacific Partnership from the people in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a part of democracy, too. It affects everything. I mean, international relations, the way we treat people around the world. This democracy, it's even more harsh for people overseas that are, when you go to these poor countries like the Philippines, South Korea, Puerto Rico, where they're using very poor people for cheap labor, they have no rights at all. And this is the Wall Street extending American democracy to other countries, where you have the right to go to work at whatever these big corporations want to pay you, which is usually some kind of really poverty wages.
Where they suppress your wages.
Yeah, I was recently, about a year ago, I was denied the right to enter Jamaica because some people from a call center asked me to come down there and help set up a union organizing committee. And the Jamaican government told me, I have the letter here someplace, they told me I would not be admitted to the country. You know,
Alan, who has more power in Washington? Is it the lobbyists, with our elected representatives, the lobbyists or the constituents
that they represent?
Well, I should say constituents, because we discussed that before.
Yeah.
Their constituents actually are the people that actually pay their way into Washington. But in this so-called democratic society, who has the power, the lobbyists or the working people?
I think it's pretty clear the lobbyists for the corporations are the ones wielding the political power in this country right now. And that's
so it's the lobbyists
serve.
And the money that's behind them.
Right. And the money that goes for campaigns is actually, it might even be small. We don't even really know. We don't know how much money these lobbyists are actually handing out there in Washington or in the state legislatures or even on city councils. We never hear about that. I asked the other day, I was at the annual meeting for a rural electric co-op up here in northern Minnesota called the Roseau Electric Co-op. And I asked them, they said, does anybody have questions? So one of the questions that I asked was, does the Roseau Electric Co-op have a lobbyist? And all of a sudden, everybody shut their mouth. And I said, well, obviously you have a lobbyist. How much are we, the members of this co-op, paying these lobbyists to go there to the state capitol here in Minnesota and tell these politicians that there is no global warming? Because they wanted, there was like 400 people there, and they wanted us all to become citizen lobbyists to go to these politicians and say, hey, there's no problem with global warming. We don't want to have high electric bills because you're forcing these coal plants to put all these pollution controls on their plants. And so that, you know, people literally hated them trying to do this. But then I asked, well, do you have a lobbyist? Are you paying a lobbyist? They still haven't answered my question. So you know, this is like a secret government, and they supposedly, you know, they will resist answering those questions. Ask any corporation, do you have a lobbyist? Ask them how much they pay that lobbyist, and ask them what that lobbyist does, and if they're handing out money to politicians, you cannot get that information out of them. They will tell you file a Freedom of Information Act, or like here in Minnesota, they call it a Data Practices Act request, and you file the request, and they say, your request is denied. The next step is to go into the courts. Well, that costs a lot of money. So we don't know. Nobody really knows what these lobbyists are doing and the way that they're controlling the politicians and, you know, literally controlling our lives.
Now, Alan, when we look at, obviously there's big money in politics, and there's big money in Washington, and money actually keeps everything going in Washington, not the voice of the people.
Right.
But we have this Citizens United, you know, basically where they wield a lot of power in politics today. Explain to our listeners what Citizens United is all about, because this is really a threat to true democracy.
Essentially, they've made the corporations, given them citizenship. A corporation is the same as a person right now in this country. And, you know, anybody with any common sense knows that a corporation should not be considered a person when it comes to politics or anything else. And, you know, we have to overturn this decision that was made by the United States Supreme Court. It's going to take a massive movement to do that. There's already quite a large movement, and the politicians aren't even listening to that. Obama made some little waves that, oh, yeah, I'm opposed to this. But what does he do? He goes right along with it, you know. So far, we haven't seen any of these politicians take really any action to set things right. Bernie Sanders brought a piece of legislation forward. I don't know. I haven't heard what's been going on with that. I wrote him a letter a couple months ago and haven't had a response yet. I think, you know, we all know what's going to happen to his legislation. It's going to die.
Just oh, yeah.
Like any other progressive legislation dies in this country right now.
DOA.
Yeah. And it's going to take a massive movement, you know, real climbing.
And our listeners need to understand, when we're talking about something like Citizens United, we're talking about billions of dollars to be able to sway the power there, not only in Washington, but also in global politics. And this is what democracy has come to in this country, where we're saying corporations are the same as people. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't get any more ridiculous than that.
Yeah, because it gives the politicians, they can say the people have created things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, technically, the people have had a say in that, but it's been just the corporations, because they're recognized as a person now. And, you know, this has to end. I don't know how it's going to end, but it's going to take massive movements and massive struggles. It'll probably have to end with the people challenging Wall Street for power, is what I think. I think it's going to take
now,
a very powerful
we're
gonna movement.
We're going to look at a couple other things in regards to when we talk about our program today is America a Democratic Society? And Alan has already explained what a democracy should be, where people essentially have control of their interpersonal relationships, their local governments. They have over their neighborhoods, where people can be able to control what is taking place in their society, and also the economy of their society. And we can see that we truly do not have this here in the U.S. But, Alan, what we're going to do is we're going to look at a couple other things in regards to when we talk about a democracy. We have two political parties in this country, essentially two. And people, when they go to the polls, they say the better of two evils. And when you look at Wall Street and the way the setup that they have is they always have plan A and plan B, and if B doesn't work, then we switch them back to A. But essentially, right, you're still getting the same A-B plan here in this country. But how does the two-party system, because we have other parties, but essentially we have a two-party system in this country. How does the two-party system, explain to our listeners how a two-party system worked for the benefit of Wall Street and the wealthy elite in our society?
Well, Wall Street controls both parties. I think most people must know that by now, because all the polls show 60-80% of the people don't trust any of the politicians or either the political parties. But it's the money. What a lot of people don't realize, though, is that a political party can do whatever it wants. If a political party tells somebody you can't come to a meeting, even though it's a public meeting, under the law, you cannot do anything. That political party has the right to exclude whoever they want. It's up to the people in that political party how their party is run. And the Democrats do this all the time. I don't even talk about the Republicans because, I wouldn't vote Republican unless Abe Lincoln rose from the grave, and I think that's probably the way most working people feel. But when it comes to the Democratic Party, we had to fight for 6 years to get a resolution passed to support single-payer universal health care. And finally we got it passed at the state convention of the Democratic Party. The day of that convention, when we were going to submit that resolution to the floor of the delegates of the convention, they actually challenged my credentials. I had been at the convention for 2 days, and yet on the third day when they were going to that resolution was being brought forward, they wouldn't allow me into the convention for over 6 hours until about 10 minutes before they declared the convention over. And yet, it's a good thing we had people in there that brought the resolution forward and everything, because it passed by like 72%. And but the next convention, what they did is they undermined that resolution by saying by putting into the title affordable health care. Well, affordable has nothing to do with single payer, and they did that to make it so that it would fit in with what Obama wanted to do. And this is the way these people operate. And they didn't even put it to a vote by the convention. They put it with resolutions that the state central committee could deal with. So the people never had any say, and that was snuck in there. That's just, I say it's small, but it's actually a very big deal when you consider health care. But that's the way these people operate.
Let me tell you how
it works in the Democratic Party. I was elected to the State Central Committee of the Minnesota Democratic Party in the same way that the other 300 or so delegates to the State Central Committee were elected, supposedly in a democratic manner. But to get me off the State Central Committee, what they did is they had the county chair announce where the county convention was going to be held. Well, the day of the county convention, there were about 90 people waiting outside the door, waiting for the doors to open. They never opened. We waited there for 2 hours. About 2.5 hours later, he drove up, and he says, "Oh, I forgot to leave a notice on the door. We changed where the meeting was going to be held and the time." He says, "Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. All of you are waiting out here, but there's nothing we can do now." And he says, "Oh, by the way, Al, you're no longer on the State Central Committee." Just like that, and this is the kind of manipulation control that they use, and this happens all the time.
Manipulation? You mean corruption?
Yeah, total corruption, total perversion of democracy, and yet
that's the way gangsters operate.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, that's when you talk about gangsters. If you look at the Democratic Party, there's a firm called Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. It's a huge lobbying firm. And Frank Schreck, he was the big shot that was responsible for pushing Obama through the first time at the Colorado Convention. Well, Frank Schreck, he represents all these mobsters in Las Vegas, and his claim to fame is that he can get anyone a gaming license. Anyone. And, you
anyone.
Know, yeah. And some of the examples that he's used are people like the Fertittas, who were part of creating Las Vegas. You know, outright mobsters. Frank Fertitta was indicted for murdering people and everything else. And this guy boasts that he can get a gaming license for everybody. And he was considered the big shot, the big wheeler and dealer at the National Democratic Party Convention. You can look up his name. You can look up Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. Brownstein is a big shot in APEC. You know, it's a, this is the way these people work. The Hyatt, this is part of the Hyatt hotel chain that's, you know, having workers fired left and right now for trying to organize. You know, and these, and if you look up Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck, you'll find that they represent literally hundreds of the major corporations in this country now.
Right.
So, you know, this is the way they manipulate, and they're registered lobbyists. They literally have hundreds of lobbyists that work in state legislatures. They work at in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. They even work on county commissions. They have lobbyists that deal with county commissioners and even city commissioners. Yeah, people should look up Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck. It's just, I don't understand why people, why some of the alternative publications aren't doing more on this. Once in a while, you'll see something in The Nation about Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, and Schreck, but nothing to really explain what's really going on with this.
Well, the reason why so many people aren't looking up this is because they're on their cell phones, they're watching television, they're reading these newspapers that have nothing but trash in them, and we're being brainwashed as a society like no society in the history of the world. And we have all this technology, but this technology is actually becoming our enemies. Alan, we have just a little over 20 minutes to go here, and I want to get into a few other things. I want to get your opinion. When we talk about a democratic society, what is your opinion about the Electoral College here in this country when we are electing our presidential candidates?
Well, I think it's got to go. I think most people agree that it's got to go. We've seen, I think, at least two presidential elections where the people that got the majority of the votes didn't win because of the Electoral College.
Right.
And, you know, you'll see them, they're scheming all the time. And you see this on the news if you look and listen close enough. But what they're doing is scheming to plan elections. They have, they gerrymander the districts and everything so that they can maintain control. And when they gerrymander these districts, the congressional districts and everything, what they're doing is making sure that they maintain control of the Electoral College system. So,
right. So the whatever the popular vote is, it basically what it does is it makes certain that the candidates, the right candidates are selected as opposed to the candidates that the people actually support.
Right. And I think, you know, Gore should have won the election and Bush won it because of the Electoral College plus the
right.
stolen votes there in Florida and Ohio.
Planned.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole thing about elections, I'll give you another example. Just, it seems like it's small, but my sister ran as a precinct delegate back in 1972, committed to George McGovern. And she ran as a write-in candidate. And she the neighborhood we lived in, it was dominated by real right-wing Democrats that were supporting George Wallace at the time. Well, come election day, they counted the ballots, and they said that she didn't get any votes. I said, well, didn't you vote for yourself? I said, I voted for you. You should have at least one vote. She says, of course I voted for myself. So I asked my mom and dad, well, didn't you vote for Susan? And they said, well, of course we did. I said, well, there's four votes, and I'm going down there. I'm going to make sure she gets those four votes. I don't care if that's all she got. Anyways, we challenged it, and the state police were sent to seize the ballot box and everything. And about a week later, they opened the ballot box and they sat there and started counting by hand. And they got to about, I think it was 90 votes or something, and they said, okay, Susan Mackey won. And and they were going to stop counting. And I says, well, no, you don't stop counting votes. I says, you know, there's like 400 or 500 votes here. Let's count them all. And by the time they got done, you know, she had the overwhelming majority of the votes, and they hadn't counted one single one of the write-in votes for her.
They hadn't counted any of them.
No, and this is just over a precinct delegate position in the Democratic Party. You know, so if they'll steal votes like that, you know, what will they do on a larger scale for things like Congress and stuff, you know? I think everybody knows in Chicago, dead people are voting all the time. You know?
Folks, I want you to listen again to the title for this program, Is America a Democratic Society? We can see that the enemies of this democracy, of a democracy, I should say, is right there in the highest places here in our government and right there in on Wall Street. And these are the people that want to make certain that we don't have a true democracy. We don't have a true voice in this society. Ellen, I want to get into a few other things when we look at democracy and many things that can really alter the lifestyles of ourselves and also take away, rob us of our freedoms, such as the Patriot Act. In a true democracy, when you look at things such as the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act, here, that was voted on in 2011, not voted on, it was signed into law by congressional members of Congress, and then the president signed this. But powerful legislation like this should be sent to the people for a vote. In a democracy, something that's going to be such a challenge to our democratic rights and freedoms and also to the Constitution, this should go before the people.
Exactly.
What would you have to say about that?
You know, well, for a long time I've advocated that there should be like plebiscites on major legislation, and it would be very, you know, with the computer age that we're living in right now, it would be very easy for people to vote from their homes on major pieces of legislation like this. And you know,
it would take less than 24 hours.
Exactly. And if you can conduct credit card business and stuff over the internet, we sure should be able to vote over the internet, you know. And
Alan, that's a good point that you brought up, because let's look at when people watch a TV program, and they can tell you the next day how many people watched that program and on average how long each person watched the program. When they have the Super Bowl, they can tell you how many people actually tuned into that program on that day. And then they can't even, such legislation that's going to affect our lives, where people don't have the opportunity to vote on that. That's what a democracy should be about.
Exactly. The tools are there to have a real democracy, and they won't permit it. The people in power, because they know that they know that the majority of the people oppose what they're doing. I don't think we've ever had a situation where so many people have actually opposed what the government is doing. And you know,
we haven't.
I've never seen poll results from all these polling organizations as lopsided as they are in this country today. And when I say lopsided, they're lopsided in favor of what should be done that is just and right in this country and for peace and social justice. And yet the government is doing just the opposite. You know, every poll that I've seen has anywhere from 60 to 80% of the people saying that these wars should be stopped and the resources used for human needs like education and housing and stuff. The people have stated their opinion over and over and over again for years now in these polls. People have voted. They put it to a vote, these questions. And wherever they put these questions to a vote, the people overwhelmingly vote against wars and for reordering the priorities in this country away from war and military spending and towards meeting human needs. And our government goes right ahead and does just the opposite.
Alan, 84% of the public, 84% were opposed to Obamacare.
Yeah.
And they could have put that instead. And here I might mention also to our listeners, Most of the congressional representatives didn't even bother to even read the legislation. But 84% were opposed to that, whereas something that was going to have has such a powerful impact on our healthcare system in this country, something like that, we had time to take that to the voters where they could have voted on that. Instead, we have a few representatives in Congress that represents the corporate elite, and a president that represents the corporate elite just sign this and vote this into law. Where is the democracy? When we talk about democracy, where's the democracy there?
There is none. It's a perfect example, again, of the lobbyists, the power of the lobbyists, because it was the lobbyists that wrote that legislation. Obamacare was a lobbyist that wrote that. The pharmaceutical industry, the American Medical Association, the hospitals, the insurance industry, it was their lobbyists that wrote that. This is a perfect example of the power of lobbyists. Then the lobbyists went and told the members of Congress, the House and the Senate, how they should vote on this, you know, and they gave them money to vote that way. We saw how people were silenced when it came to single-payer universal health care. You know, I fought real hard for single-payer universal health care, and today I think that we should no longer bother with single-payer universal health care. We should be talking about a national public health care system in this country, and that's
exactly
the debate that should take place, because it doesn't do any good to talk just about something like single-payer, because then they say that, well, we compromised with you. You got Obamacare. That's essentially what they're saying. And that eventually, it will all work out. Just be patient and give it time, and eventually you'll have single-payer universal health care.
Well, Obamacare is what the big insurance industry, the pharmaceuticals and health care industry, that's what they wanted. That's what
exactly.
They got.
It's the Profit Maximization Act for the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry and the doctors. You know, if you notice, the doctors said that they were for single-payer universal health care, but that was because single-payer universal health care leaves them free to profit from health care. So they didn't care if the insurance company was cut out, just so they could continue to profit from health care. And it's doctors' organizations that establish the rates and everything that the government pays them for Medicare and Medicaid. You know, this is not democracy. This is democracy by the very few dictating the terms of what government is going to do.
Alan, we have also have been launched into several wars and conflicts with no democratic consensus from the public, and we know it's their wars and it's our blood, and
right. We
have lost many of our young men and women, not to mention millions of people have died in several countries, including Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq. Again, back to what we're saying, why isn't it? Why do we not have, when it comes to war, why is it that wars are not put to the public's vote? Because this is going to affect not only our livelihood and our families, but let's say our livelihood, because it's affecting the lives of our children, our community. It has the most severe effects on a nation is war. Why isn't the Congress, why aren't working people included in that debate?
Because there would be no wars. Working people historically never want wars. They know that it's working people that like themselves that die, and it's the big corporations that profit from wars. And once again, you have profits at stake. You have the lobbyists lobbying for the militarism, and the militarism, obviously it leads to wars. This past weekend, we had what they call the skirmish in Afghanistan. 11 little kids, very small kids, were killed in that. You know, there's nobody that wants to talk about how much a skirmish like that cost. And, you know, how much did it cost us to kill those little kids? And, you know, what could we have? What could we have instead of that money that's being spent on the wars. We could have a national public health care system. We could have a national public child care system, free health care, free child care for everybody in this country, even for the millionaires. You know, let them have free health care and free child care, too. Who cares? But, you know, these are the things that we're giving up so that these rich people can fight these wars, so that Wall Street can fight the wars. We're going without these things, and the people in other countries, you know, their children are being murdered and slaughtered. I don't know if you saw the picture of the 11 little kids laid out there on a rug.
And, it's all over Facebook.
Yeah, and
it's all over the internet. You can't miss it. Not unless you have your hands over your eyes.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know how people. I've heard people say that they cried when they saw these pictures and everything. But everybody knows nobody wants this war. They claim that they're winding down this war, and yet you see this kind of carnage going on. You know, and it's. Totally, the masses of people in this country and around the world are opposed to these wars, and yet these rich people continue to fight the wars and start the wars. Now they're trying to start a war in Syria. They're trying to start a war in Iran.
In 2008, what did Obama promise the people if they were to vote for him? What was his promise?
He promised peace in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And
exactly.
That,
Obama said, if you elect me into office, this is Obama's statement, I will have our troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq within 9 months of being in office. 9 months.
Yeah.
Here we are now. We're in the fifth year.
And the only way he got reelected was by spending over $1 billion. So it's... you know, and
Alan,
those people
this is the last
don't have any say.
Part of this, what we're going to get into is we're looking at a lot of money that's being spent, and all of this money is on the backs of working people. You have to realize, on this administration, close to $6 billion have already been spent, and that's only the money that we know about. But when we look at the monies that are being spent, well, let's go into two administrations, the Bush administration, where George Bush, President Bush said, we have a crisis, and if we don't get $700 billion, this economy is going to collapse. That was 2 months before the election in 2008.
Right.
And so he got his $700 billion, and then near the election, then Nancy Pelosi said, once he gets elected, there's going to be, we will have a stimulus package ready for another $825 billion. Well, Bush got his $700 billion, which it went straight to Wall Street. And then Obama got his, which was $787 billion, which again went to Wall Street, and no jobs were created. When we're talking about $1.5 trillion within 4 months of an election, why wasn't that taken to the American people? Why do we have a few members in Congress make a decision on $1.5 trillion and it was never taken to the Americans for a vote that close to an election?
Well, because they knew that it would be defeated. And that's the way the government is being run. Anytime that they know something is going to be defeated, they just pretend that they don't know that the opposition is there, and they go ahead and vote the way the lobbyists and the corporations tell them to vote. It's as simple
Alan, how
as that.
Do we wake this nation up?
Well, I think
because
the nation
we can
is,
see that something is wrong.
I think the
if,
nation.
If we think this is a democracy, we're deceiving ourselves. How do we wake this nation up to realize that? This is a plutocracy. It is not a democracy, and we're being taken to the cleaners. How do you wake people up?
Well, I think that people are pretty much woke up in this country right now, but what they don't understand is what needs to be done in order to change things, the kind of organization that it's going to take. The only way to defeat these people is through massive organization of the people fighting against against Wall Street and fighting Wall Street for power is what it amounts to. We're going to have to challenge Wall Street for power and for political and economic power. And that is the struggle that we're faced with in this country today. They're not going to listen to any little reforms. And when I say little, I mean, if you even look at Social Security, that's a major thing that people have relied on. And Obama is leading the fight now to take some of that Social Security away from people. So,
exactly.
It's going to take a massive struggle in this country, people out in the streets. We saw, thousands of people in the streets in Wisconsin, thousands of people in the streets in Michigan, and some of these big shots in the unions, they channel all that energy back into the Democratic Party rather than starting a new political party that would fight for the interest of working people, that would fight for jobs and for real programs and the reordering of priorities in this country. Richard Trumka won't even open his mouth in opposition to these dirty wars that are killing jobs the same way they kill people. This is a dirty shame. It's going to have to take massive opposition from the rank-and-file workers in this country to take control of their unions so that the unions can begin to do what is right by the majority of the working people in this country. And it's going to be a big struggle, and people are going to have to start to talk about what they're going to do and what can be done to get people in motion and keep them in motion. Those people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania, they should have been kept in motion, and we should have been organizing people into motion all across this country in the same way. Instead, these big shots, they channeled it back into the Democratic Party and said, vote for Obama, and he will solve your problems. Well, a lot of people didn't believe that. We saw, a lot of people didn't bother to even go vote. And unless we have a new party, we're going to probably see more and more people not voting because more and more people are realizing there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans. They all support big business. So, I think the first thing we need in this country is people to keep active in the streets, and the next thing we need is a new political party representing the interest of working people.
Need a new political party because the two that we have are not working for working people, and the two, they do not stand for any democratic order in the country as well. Alan, I'd like to thank you once again for joining the program. How can people reach you?
Oh, they can just Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll find my telephone number, 218-386-2432. They'll find my email, and I have a blog called the Podunk Blog, and all that information is on there. I'm also on Facebook. You can find me under my name. So,
Alan, I always enjoy having you on as my guest. You're an excellent guest and very knowledgeable about many of the issues that we're confronted with every day. We look forward to having you to join us once again next week. You can reach any comments. Just go to stuartalexandercares.com, and there is a contact section where you can put your comments. Or if you'd like to reach me, it's stuartalexandercares.com. And we'll be looking forward to having you to join us once again next week on The Socialist Insight. Thanks again, Alan.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Have a good night.
You too.
listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole Radio Show with Cynthia Hamill. Tonight we welcome guest James Walbert. He speaks on a historically important topic of psychotronic weapons, dealing with microchip technology and civil and personal rights violations. Folks, this is more than a conspiracy theory. James has the toxicological studies backing up his claims and information. This is a show that you will definitely want to hear. Welcome to the show, James. Glad you're here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for the opportunity to speak out against the crime.
Yes, definitely. Well, I've had James on my show a couple of times before, and we're now speaking about 8 months after the last interview that we did. So can you tell us of any new developments on this front and what's going on lately?
Well, things are pretty much just about the same as any other logical person as well as victim can figure out. This is a very hard thing to evidence in any courts, as well as a very difficult process as far as getting any type of technologies removed from your body. It's very costly. They can range anywhere from $10,000 to maybe $12,000 per implant to be removed. And I'm looking at 5 implants that have been identified right now. So it's a very costly process. I'm in the process of raising money. I've already found several physicians that are very interested in removing it. One of the physicians have been very successful in recovering a microchip from another inventor, inventor Bob Boyce. He is in North Carolina. He had gone in for a biopsy of a tumor, and they had removed the tumor, and inside the tumor they had found an RFID tracking chip. So I have inquired to him, and he said that he would be very happy to be involved with my case, testify, as well as remove the actual chips themselves that are within my body.
Excellent. And I remember hearing on one of your previous interviews that Dr. John Hall was the one who discovered that you had 5. Is that right, located above the neck?
Yes, yes. Dr. John Hall had read the MRI. He had found the tracker chip that's in my right shoulder and my trapezius. And from there, I was able to send the MRI around to other physicians. Of course, with such a touchy subject, you're going to want to get, you know, more than one, you know, physician's professional opinion and diagnostics. So I had sent it to 5 doctors, and every single one of them had come back in agreement that there was definitely something in my right shoulder that was an area of concern. So I had... And that had prompted me enough concern to get involved with several private investigators that had validated it with radio frequency, infrascope, and other styles of detection. They had confirmed the fact that it most certainly is a foreign body that is emitting frequencies, which conclusively leads us to believe and confirm that it is without a doubt a microchip, a tracking chip. So,
right.
Yeah. You know,
wow. You know, I also had heard on with Raytheon, which is a defense company located in the San Diego area. I know a couple of friends who actually work there. So I'm wondering, was that confirmed, or was that just a portion that I briefly heard on the radio?
Oh, sure. You know, Raytheon has been responsible for hundreds of non-lethal weapon test developments as well as non-consensual tests that have been performed on the public at large. I've been very successful in speaking with investigators, legislators, and congressional members that have all confirmed these illegal tests against the American public. Now, I've had officers from the Department of Defense out of Kansas City, not only did they agree that it was illegal, but they had also gone into some serious great detail about explaining that there are soldiers or there are contractors that are sewn into small pockets of society that are using these technologies on people at will. So, and they're all part of a non-consensual, you know, illegal test.
Wow, it's just hard to imagine. And I think the general public they just really don't know about this, because Had I not have taken the time to really research chemtrails and where this whole thing was leading, there's no way I would have understood what this is all about, because it's just so far out. I mean, there's just no way that you would even in your wildest imagination actually believe that someone could be microchipped and that somebody could be trying to remotely control this. So can you kind of give us a little bit of personal information on this and how this, how your body responds to this and what actually takes place when you're receiving signals from this?
Sure. The weapons are basically designed for neurological, physiological manipulation of synapses firing patterns, as well as cortical manipulation. And the cortical is basically like a regional map of the brain. And there's certain systems that are identified, as well as they're able to affect specific areas and specific functionalities. And we had been very successful in obtaining documents under the Freedom of Information Act that explains that these weapons, and these are hand-signed documents from the Department of Defense, they were delivered to this man's door, and he made copies of them and sent them everywhere. These documents are just, they're phenomenal. They're amazing confirmation of the five new development of non-lethal weapons technology. Three out of the five are actual silent sound, microwave auditory effect technologies, which allows the perpetrator to actually communicate with their victim. And it's under a style of microwave hearing. So that's one of the styles of technologies.
James, the V2K voice-to-skull technology, and it's also known as Frey microwave hearing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
The actual term V2K is just slang. If you were to Google that, you would find a lot of opinions. You wouldn't be able to find actual physical studies that have been confirmed by scientists like James C. Lynn and other scientists as well. There's hundreds of them out there. James Lynn he's been studying that and developing the microwave auditory effect technology since 1971. So they've been able to, now with his help, I was able to learn that the technology most certainly is real, because I deal with victims that suffer from these symptoms. And when I was receiving calls from them and trying to help them, I was not able to understand right away exactly what, you know, they were talking about, because I've studied psychology for years, and usually a person that suffers from a mental ailment, you know, suffers from, you know, or schizophrenia, they'll suffer from a series or a pattern of inaudible effects. They'll hear voices, you know, but the terminology inaudible is, you know, literated for a reason, because these victims are not able to understand what's being said to them. All they know is they're hearing a pattern of, you know, garble. Well, the people that I was speaking with are able to actually write down full sentences of what's being spoken to them. So I had questioned the technology. I studied the technology that was in question. I spoke with scientists that were fluent in the technology for over 40 years. And this guy, you know, James Lynn, he's all about it. I mean, he told me things that he's like, well, if you got a person that's able to write down what's being spoken to them, then they're definitely not a person, an individual that's suffering from a mental ailment. He said, what that would lead me to believe is that they are most definitely a victim of an illegal military test. Now, this is the BEMS Society. One of the presidential members of the Bioelectromagnetic Society of European and basically worldwide, and their society is called BEMS, B-E-M-S. You can Google them and find them on the internet. And basically what they study is bioelectromagnetic effects upon the human physiology. So keeping that in mind, the man is very, very accredited, you know, with what he's making comments upon. You know, he's been studying the technology for over 40 years and had actually been, you know, responsible for developing the technology to pick up and sense and communicate with algorithms, as well as auditory cortex, you know, and things like that, cortical areas of the brain. They're able to, not only are they able to see the functionality, they're able to actually manipulate that functionality and communicate with the victim at the same time. So that means that they're able to observe you in your home, in the privacy of your private moments. So while you're under this the scrutiny or the exposure of this technology. You're living under the scrutiny of their, you know, their vicious slander. Victims have told me that there's, you know, death threats that have been made. I've received physical extortion threats, you know, but that's been a very long time ago and nothing's ever transpired from it. So, but the majority of victims that were speaking to me about it, they were all, and every single story, Cynthia, all of them was all the same. So it shows me that the program is cookie cutter. It's definitely something that's just flipped over and over and over again. And what's going on the entire time, you know, with these victims are, you know, the crimes of revenge, crimes of defamation. They'll defile their characters because they very well may be, you know, gay. They very well may be a drug dealer. They very well may be a violent individual. There could be, I work with detectives that also have very super wealthy, you know, clients that have also coincidentally became victims upon receiving very large sums of money. So the technology is used in a criminal state, not only by the government, but also by individuals, family members. You know, there's been, you know, cases that I've discussed with private investigators and confirmed that they have arrested family members in the past and put them in, you know, federal prison for these crimes. You know, there's also been investigators that have revealed information to me that they have been very successful in arresting, you know, individuals, not just private citizens. They have nothing to do with the military, the government, or anything, that have actually obtained the equipment, and they've arrested them under the clause of sexual abuse. They were putting people in prison for sexual abuse of their neighbors, sexual abuse of their relatives, and they were using the exact same style of technology that's being described by
Whoa.
These victims. So,
wow.
Yeah.
This comes into such a human rights issue because the majority of the public is not aware that this is going on. Maybe like 2% of the population may even have an inkling that this is going on, and the rest of the 98% is asleep on this matter. I mean, nobody knows about it. So one of the things that struck me about you and why I wanted to bring you back on the radio show was the fact that you were able to get through all these different legislative type things, moving your case forward, and you actually are responsible for 2 House bills in the state of Missouri. So, James, you know, I'd love to brag on you about that, but if you could tell us a bit more about that, and what was it within you that motivated you to push that through? Because very few people can actually come up against this. We're talking about a crime that's virtually completely invisible. People cannot see it. Only the person who is experiencing this can actually hear the voice-to-skull commands or the Frey microwave hearing within their head and everything. So if you can kind of explain your motivation and how you were able to move forward and get these 2 House bills going in the state of Missouri, I'm really, really, you know, pulling for you on that. And it's you know, astounding to actually be able to talk to somebody who's doing something with this and actually moving something forward and making some major progress. So we've, you know, I don't know that the audience realizes it or not, but we've basically got someone on the same level as like Dr. Martin Luther King or even Gandhi. I mean, this is such a human rights violation. James has made so much progress. I just want to brag on you, man. I mean, you're doing a great job. So tell us about these House bills.
In 2009, I was very successful in addressing the courts of Sedgwick County, Kansas, here in Wichita. And during that process, I was granted an order of protection against the technology that prior to the issuing of my order that supposedly just didn't exist. Many police officers as well as any law enforcement agencies had all denounced the technology and, you know, were trying to get to a place where they could actually label an individual, you know, with a mental ailment for just simply being a victim. And from there, I mean, I was able to produce the evidence as well as, you know, living, breathing eyewitnesses that had actually, you know, been in cahoots with the guy that owns the equipment. So they're testifying against this guy because of the styles of abuses that he's introducing to people. And from there, I had obtained the order of protection against any and all energized devices that are designed to affect the human nervous system, microwave tracking, electromagnetic tracking, as well as the restraining order is against the implantation of illegal tracking technologies. So I was able to achieve an actual restraining order against the equipment that is designed to couple with the implant itself. So I was able to get an order to force them to abstain from having the electronics on my body, as well as a protection order against the technology that had already been implanted in my body. So there was a lot of strategy there that went on. And from there, I introduced that case to a friend. He posted it to a website. Now, within 7 to 10 days, it was sitting on over 1.5 million websites just instantly.
Wow.
I was totally shocked. I had everybody and their mother contacted me because I had no idea what I had done. And I had some of the highest profile private investigators, you know, contacting me, as well as, you know, high profile members like Dr. John Hall or Dr. Robert Duncan. You're like, wow, you know, this is something that we've all been waiting for, you know, somebody that's actually able to evidence what they're saying. You know, how did you do it? You know, so I went through the whole process, you know, I mean, and it wasn't near as hard as what a lot of people might think. You know, I just got in, you know, with the right people right off the bat. I really truly think that, you know, it is the hand of God that put me into that path, that was able to guide me onto, you know, a fast track of being able to evidence what was going on with these people. Because, of course, you know, he knew what was up. You know, he could see this evil crime below him, you know, and I know without a doubt that I would not have been able to do it without him. So, but either way, I had taken the order of protection, freedom from covert harassment and surveillance, and Derek Robertson's group. He had been working closely with State Representative Jim Guest, but they had a very minuscule amount of evidence. So he had contacted me, and he's like, well, James, you're the only one I know that has evidence quite this profound. You know, would you be willing to sit in on a conference call? So, of course, I sat in on the conference call. And we did the conference call. I introduced a mound of evidence to State Representative Jim Guest, 5th District out of the state of Missouri. And he is basically the political leader over one of the largest cities, one of the largest populated areas in the state of Missouri. So it's right next to Kansas City. So I spoke with him on the conference call. I guess there's probably maybe 8 to 10 people there. And then he called me individually. He went ahead and took the time and called me directly. So I spoke with him one-on-one. He said, what you've done, he's like, you have just provided an amazing amount of evidence. He said, I would like to see all of this documentation, you know, on my desk. So he gave me his mailing address and all points of contact, home number, cell phone number, Yahoo, chat lines. I mean, every single point of contact. He said, you stay in contact with me. He said, you know, you and I are going to make something happen. And I was like, great,
cool.
You know, he said, because this is what I've been waiting for. He said, you know, for God's sakes, you know, they're microchipping cows out here in Missouri. He said, I got a handful of farmers that are just losing their minds because the government's demanding, you know, that these cows or animals, you know, be microchipped. He said, and now, you know, he said, that was a huge major issue. He said, and then, here you come with solid evidence that not only are they microchipping cows, you know, and tracking them, he said, they're doing it to humans too, you know. And
yeah.
So I had worked very closely with him for several years, you know, and he said that after all the evidence I was able to deliver to him, about 250 pages of documentation that I was able to deliver to him, he said that, you know, without a doubt, he is going to, that my case and the amount of evidence that I had introduced to him compelled him, you know, to actually start working on a House bill that would illegalize this entire crime and its descriptiveness, you know.
Wow.
So,
that's excellent. High five. Very good. Very good. That's cool. You know, I also want to go back over the story for my audience and tell them, you know, kind of what happened and why you were introduced to this microchip electronic harassment and, you know, the invention that you came up with and, you know, the people who wanted to keep you from moving forward with that, because that's a big, you know, that's a very big part of the story. You know, it's something that really can add more depth to the understanding of, you know, what do these people have to gain for doing all this stuff? They're basically trying to block you from coming out with you know, a life-saving possible, you know, invention, right?
Yeah, most definitely. It was no coincidence, you know, and this is what, you know, led me to believe as well as confirm that, you know, my particular crime, you know, is zero to do with the government. It's a 100% personal, you know, crime against myself, you know, that are being done by individuals that are around in my life. You know, these people are nobodies. You know, after a 9-year period, they've gotten nowhere against me. You know, if anything, I've been so successful against them that, I mean, it's got to be a very frustrating, humiliating state that they live in. And now, you know, I mean, not only has their victim been responsible for exposing their crime in a very credible manner, their victim has also been responsible for, you know, compelling, you know, laws and house bills and legislators and, you know, political members and congressional members. It doesn't seem like it's been very effective against myself. You know, now, keeping that in mind, that shows me that, you know, retrospect being 2020, these people that have been suffering from this crime for decades, you know, that has been, you know, implemented by the government, you know, these people, no matter what their political stature has been, there's been former FBI agents, special agents that have been drugged and chipped and made victims of this, and they've gotten nowhere. And that's because they're battling against professionals, you know, people that were trained to do this to an individual. The people that I'm battling with, more than obvious, are nothing but a bunch of they're idiots, in my opinion. There is no possible way that this is what they intended to happen. This is, I mean, my case, if this is mind control, boy, it just backfired right in his face, you know? I mean, it just seems like, I mean, seriously, there's been nothing out there, no other case out there to date that has been successful in any way, shape, or form on even being accepted by any court, let alone to prove that the technology actually exists and to actually compel a court enough, you know, to put a restraining order against it, you know. So that is, you know, judicial and legal acknowledgement of the actual technology, confirmation of the technology, as well as a legal concern that the technology is being used through the amount of evidence that I was able to introduce. So that shows me a big difference between professionals as well as, you know, government actually implementing the crime onto other victims, and then myself and these baboons that I have that are trying to do something and living in a constant state of failure after 9 years. They've had no success against me at all. I've never been labeled with any mental ailments. Actually, I've had 3 doctors do blood tests, and in my medical records, they have pretty much banished the chance that I'm ever going to be labeled with a mental ailment, because every single thing in there credits me. All the reports say that James does not suffer from any mental ailments at all.
Obvious. Just talking with you, you know, you're a brilliant guy. You're an inventor. You came up with this whole antibacterial film sanitization method for beverage cans that would basically stop the distribution of germs, right, for the common cold. And so you're a brilliant guy, and they're wanting to stop your invention, which, you know, to me kind of reminds me of what they did with Tesla. You know, have you studied much of Tesla's history?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm not the only inventor, though, that they've done this to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but, yes, it does seem to have a cookie-cutter commonality, you know. I mean, the invention is 100% their motivation, Cynthia, without a doubt. And that's why I was trying to, like, you know, cover the bases between government crimes as well, you know, the difference between government and individual, you know, contractor crimes, or just, you know, the average, you know, criminal, you know, the ones that are going to, you know, try to extort you, because it was no coincidence that I had developed this invention of mine, and then I had introduced it to the United States Patent and Trademark Office. I was granted 7 patents on it, you know. I mean, so I have 7 patents on this thing to date. You know, people that suffer from mental ailments cannot even, you know, hardly construct their life every day, you know, let alone, you know, conduct and, you know, get awarded 7 patents in a row. So it's not something that is even, you know, comparable to what other victims seem to be suffering from. If I were a victim of government technology, I know for a fact they would have never allowed that to happen. They would have been able to stop me. I've seen it too many times. there are too many high-profile professionals, and you've spoke with them yourself, and Dr. Robert Duncan, Dr. John Paul, Special Agent Ted Gunderson, another Special Agent, Gerald Softy. You know, these are, you know, people that are extremely high-profile in their field of expertise, and they are victims of the technology, and they can't seem to get anywhere against it. You know, I mean, they're scientists and special agents for the federal, you know, Bureau of Investigations. I mean, these people are, I'm a maintenance technician, man. You know, I mean, I'm a blue-collar worker. I am as average Joe as it gets, you know. So I definitely, you know, it was no coincidence. I woke up, you know, 3 days after, actually within the first week of marketing my invention, you know, to companies for acceptance, you know, and I woke up, you know, 3 days after that, and I had been drugged and chipped, you know, and the doctors have confirmed it, and they, all they keep doing is just confirming it more and more and more. So now I'm in the process of raising, you know, funds to actually get down to, you know, the area where the doctor's at to have the technologies removed. So
excellent. Now, the first time I saw you on a YouTube video, it was with the Presidential Commission of Bioethics with Amy Guttman. And this was actually an appointment, I believe, by Obama, wasn't it, where he commissioned 20 people to speak in a hearing format in front of Amy Guttman and a group of, you know, basically kind of almost like a trial. Can you kind of explain that and explain what the outcome of that was?
Yeah, the presidential appointed bioethics committee, they were basically put together, you know, of course, by the president himself. He had chose the highest of the medically educated, you know, individuals throughout the United States, as well as research scientists that, you know, coincide with these other professionals. They had put together a panel, and they basically what they were addressing. Victims of non-consensual testings of any kind by the United States government, whether it be, you know, introductions of, you know, obscure diseases, you know, whether you're a victim of, like, illegal psychiatric testing like MK Ultra, as well as, you know, McNaomi. There's so many named, you know, programs that are out there, MC Chaos, you know, there's an awful lot of them out there. I could go on and on and on for hours, you know, about how many programs that are out there, COINTELPRO, you know, and they're all, every single program that's being conducted, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of victims that are completely unwitting. They have no knowledge that they're even being observed, let alone being affected and manipulated in such a horrible manner, you know, and that's where, you know, they had projected their efforts. They focused their efforts on those particular victims. So what they're, why they were put together was to basically confirm the damages, and I do believe that they're looking, you know, for case studies to confirm, as well as, you know, compensation from the damages that have been, you know, as well as, you know, official apologies and things like that. So, but
right,
the outcome, as far as the targeted individuals were concerned, there had been several victims that had received letters. Now, I never received a letter like this. I introduced a 100-page portfolio of solid evidence. I mean, there was phone numbers, addresses, email addresses of congressional members, all the way down to just, you know, private investigators. So I had never received a letter of negativity from them. If anything, all the communications I've ever received from them personally have been, all of them have been positive. They had, you know, told me that this is going to be anywhere from a 1 to 1.5 year tour of the entire area of exposure of these illegal tests, and then a collection of the evidence of the illegal tests. Then they will review it, investigate it, and then they will apply, you know, their end result. So this is not a process that's going to happen overnight. They're telling all of us that this is a process that's going to happen over a duration of years, you know, so it's not something that you're just going to be able to walk in, grab 1,000 people, you know, introduce their evidence back to the president and say, hey, you know, this is what we found. What are we going to do about it? You know, this is way more in-depth, detailed study and investigation than what a lot of people had expected.
Did they ever have a follow-up meeting to that, or was it a one-time only shot?
Well, there have been some victims that were following the actual tour, you know, around the United States. There were like several cities, five cities. I do believe it's five major cities. that were announced, and then several other small cities that were not announced. You know, so there are, you know, areas that were being, there were meetings that were taking place that not everyone knew about, you know, to keep out the ruckus is what I'm guessing, you know. But as far as the end result is concerned, the majority of victims had received letters mailed to their homes telling them that they're not going to be investigating their crimes. Anything to do with MKUltra, COINTELPRO, basically the common programs that have been going on, that they're not going to investigate them. To date, I have not received a letter stating anything of the sort. So, I mean, I don't know if, which mine addresses the issue of illegal drugging and implanting, illegal human tracking, and abuses of children. That's been my whole motivation on why I got involved to begin with. I'm an adult. If somebody wants to hide from me like a child and cry about, you know, all the things they're not man enough to say to my face or man enough to do to my face, then so be it, because it's just mud on their face. It just makes them look like a bigger idiot, you know, because they were gutless. They were cowards, you know. It doesn't affect my life. I mean, so, but if you're sexually attacking children or drugging children, if you're affecting the children of our country, that's where I'm going to, you know, stand up and do what I can, you know, to curb the crime. So that's been
my
motivation.
That's admirable, James. I really admire that. Very cool. Now, going back to the Presidential Commission of Bioethics, I would like to say to my audience, if you get a chance, please pull that up on Google. You can go to Google, go to YouTube, and the name of it is called The Presidential Commission of Bioethics with Amy Guttman. It's G-U-T-M-A-N-N, two N's. So that's pretty unbelievable. If people are having a difficult concept grasping this and understanding exactly what's going on with the human rights violations, if they pull up that series of 20 people that talk, and Dr. John Hall is on that video, and several other people, there's an attorney who's speaking up on behalf of the civil rights violations, and several other people speak up, as well as about probably 15 or so targeted individuals all speaking up on behalf of this. So that's a profound video series. I think it's about a 4 or 5 part video series on YouTube. And if you pull that up, I think you're going to be literally shocked to hear what people are saying about this technology and how invasive it is to people's lives and how this affects people. So if you've not seen that yet, it's an eye-opener. You definitely need to, you know, pull that up and watch that. Pull out the popcorn and watch that thing from start to finish. It's pretty profound. So are there any other things that you can guide my audience to, James, where they could learn more about this technology? Have you found any new videos or anything that would really help people understand this?
I would think that the only advice that I would be able to give is, you know, education, for them to educate themselves. You know, there, of course, you know, are going to be, you know, agents that are going to be sown within the crowds of victims to actually, you know, herd the cattle and then keep them in a state of arraignment to corral them, you know, and keep them down with many, many, you know, discrediting moves, disinformation, you know, arranging huge groups of conference calls that will literally get you nowhere. I mean, it's no coincidence that there's thousands of victims, hundreds of them have evidence, and coincidentally, none of them could get anywhere. I think that there's probably a few more, you know, goats out there than what a lot of people might think. You know, agents sown within the crowds of victims, misleading them and misguiding them, you know, into areas of unsuccessfulness, and they're doing it on purpose, and it's a very effective tactic, you know. So there's a lot of disinformation that's out there on the internet. The best way to educate yourself, of course, is to, you know, conduct professional scientific research studies. You know, get a hold of these individuals. It's just a phone call. You know, I mean, it's always better, you know, to answer your questions than it is to defamate, you know, or slander or put down somebody else, you know, simply because they're speaking about something that you have no knowledge of at all. So education is the key factor of any success, you know, or comprehension of the information that's being introduced that I would, you know, advise to people.
Right. Now, you did mention Dr. Robert Duncan, and he's been on my radio show before. He's basically the architect of this technology, from what I can gather, and he's you know, a Harvard grad. He worked for the CIA, the Department of Defense. He's got a book out called Project Soul Catcher, and that book basically covers the A to Z application and technology of what this is all about. And I'm not talking out of my hat here, and neither is James. I mean, this stuff is so divisive. It's just unbelievable how this can actually control people and groups of people, and they may not even be aware of it. So the programs are all listed in this book, and I would definitely recommend that. He's also going to be speaking in Henderson at a conference that's coming up called the Super Soldier Summit. You can find that at supersoldiersummit.com. I believe the dates of that are May. Let me look on my calendar real quick. May the 18th through the 19th or something, and so that's coming up very soon, and he's going to be one of the leading speakers at that. So I do recommend that people, if they have an interest in this or if they want to learn more, he'll be right outside of Vegas in Henderson, just south of Vegas, for that 3-day conference. So anything else that you would like to say, James, about the technology and how this personally has affected you and how you're dealing with it?
The only last thing I would like to cover, you know, is maybe, you know, like the steps I'm going to take, you know, after the technology has been removed from my body and confirmed 100%. You know, I do plan, you know, to get together with the other implanted victims, you know, such as elected official David Larson, there's another inventor, Dave Case, and then there's another inventor, Bob Boyce. I would like for us to get together and try to, you know, maybe address, you know, Congress in a professional manner and actually implement federal laws against this, because now we're experiencing 21 states that are issuing statutory, you know, laws against this. So now they have recognized the technology. They have seen that it is a point of concern enough where they're introducing House bills. California, there's a handful of them that have been very successful in passing it. California Civil Penal Code 52.7, they've been very successful in introducing House Bill 362. It graduated to 52.7 Penal Code, which makes it a crime to actually even speak to an individual, you know, to try to coerce them into it, let alone to drug them and actually implant their body. That law is on the books. And there's, you know, several other states that are issuing House bill after House bill after House bill, you know, trying to force it through, you know, and implement it into an actual unlawful, you know, criminal state. So that's something that I would like to work on personally, is to, you know, go ahead and get together with these people, because these people are, you know, they're not, you know, and not to say that, you know, a person of, you know, average intellect, you know, is lesser deserving, you know, it could be a lesser, you know, key pivot point to any gain against this crime. But these are recognized, you know, elected officials. These are recognized famous inventors. These are recognized, you know, political members. You know, they're pretty high up on the sociological, you know, actually the social stature, you know. I mean, so they're not just your average layman. These are, you know, political and very, you know, highly revered and recognized, you know, professionals. You know, so that's my personal endeavor, is to actually, you know, address Congress, you know, with our evidence and say, hey, if we've got 21 states that are showing statutory concern of the same exact crime that we have solid, tangible, physical evidence that we have suffered from, then I think that, you know, that would be enough to compel Congress to actually implement federal law and order against what's going on. That way, it doesn't supersede, you know, a statutory implementation, but what it will do is it will coincide with it, because these crimes, like in California, for every single day that it's just a misdemeanor. But what you got to keep in mind is that it's a daily collective misdemeanor. So for every 24-hour period, a Californian or a California constituent has been implanted. For every 24-hour period is another fold of a malicious misdemeanor against you. Over a very short period of time, it becomes a felonious crime. Then it graduates into a continuous statutory offense, which shows morbidity of the crime. So the crime is like a collective cancer. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger every single 24-hour period. Now, keep in mind, for all the 21 states that have implemented this law or introduced these House bills and laws into their state, all of them say the same thing. They're all written the same, that this is a malicious attack, a battery, assault with intent against the individual, and it starts out as a misdemeanor. Then it graduates
exactly.
to a flow, I mean, and then it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So these perpetrators are now residing in a constant state of criminal act against the individual. The longer that that implant is in their body, the bigger and bigger and bigger it gets. So these people are just racking up more years and more time. So,
and one of the things that I found with the technology after interviewing probably like 6 to 8 people with my last series of Research Rabbit Hole radio shows, what we tapped into was that the smart dust that they're spraying with the chemtrails is basically filled with nanobot technology. So they no longer actually need to microchip people. We're actually breathing that in. We are immersed in that whole technology. We are like, that stuff is alive around us, all the smart dust, this little nanobot technology. So they are able to program groups of people and target individuals basically after spraying all these chemtrails. So this is where the rabbit hole goes. A lot of people don't realize that, but this is exactly where this rabbit hole goes. And that's why I'm bringing in the psychotronic weapons, because people don't understand the links and how this all ties in until they get into this part of it, this type of dynamic. And this is why they were killing people to keep them quiet over this. There were interviews on the radio that I first came across when I first delved into the chemtrails that, you know, people were speaking out, like A.C. Griffin. He was speaking out and said, you know, there have been people that were killed just to keep them quiet about this, because the government does not want people to know what is actually behind all of this. So their ultimate goal, it appears, is to be able to control the entire population, which is absolutely like something out of Austin Powers, like Dr. Evil or something, you know. Mini-me, you know. It's just absolutely unbelievable. Can you imagine? So we definitely need to put a lid on this. And, James, I was just going to ask you this. Now, what about filing a class action lawsuit and getting everybody rounded up and together on this? What about doing something like that?
I definitely think that, you know, if one could be successful in gathering, you know, a group of individuals, you know, that have solid, irrefutable, you know, tangible physical evidence about what is going on, you know, as well as a panel of expert witnesses, I would definitely, you know, be interested in, you know, participating or, you know, actually seeing something like that, you know, being erected and, you know, taking effect. I would definitely, you know, suggest or support something like that. But, you know, from, you know, past observations, there's not been a whole lot of people that have been able to prove, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt or compel a court, you know, to a compensatory, you know, state of, benefit for the actual group of victims. So, I would definitely think that that would be a lot more powerful than just, you know, single individuals, you know, going in and repetitively, you know, achieving something. If they could actually cite cases, you know, like mine or Bob Boyce's or David Larson's, you know, that have been very successful in proving the technology exists, as well as, you know, that are implanted with the technology, then yeah, you know, I mean, I think that that would be something that would be, you know, progressively successful.
I think it's the next step, because obviously they're not going to stop this type of, you know, non-consensual human testing without some type of legal ramifications. They need somebody barking up their tree, if you get what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a
yeah.
Texas thing. Most people won't get it, but you know what I mean. It's like somebody needs to take some action to put an end to this, because otherwise they're just going to keep doing the same old, you know?
Exactly, you know, and that's exactly what seems to be taking, you know, place here, you know, in a lot of the cases, because, you know, there's people out there that say that they've been victims for 40 years, you know, that's as long as I've been alive, you know, I mean, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, that I couldn't imagine living until I'm 80, you know, being a victim of this technology and never doing anything against it, but complain about it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are not taking steps to alleviate their particular situation at all. You know, they'll get on, you know, the calls, they'll get into areas, and it seems like all they will do is just complain about the situation, and they will do nothing to relieve themselves of it. And not to say that it's bad, because a lot of people that suffer from trauma, you know, it's a very hard thing psychologically. A traumatic experience will, without a doubt, compel a person to verbally, you know, expulse this stress. You know, they will expel it from their bodies, you know, I mean, and it's a natural process. But, you know, I would just rather see the same people, you know, that are applying that much effort to sit on them calls for 4 or 5 hours straight and just conversing about, you know, their pain, their experiences, you know, if they would put that much effort into actually solving something, you know, or moving towards, you know, something that would help, you know, that's what I would rather, you know, be a part of or organize or, you know, see these victims, you know, as well as myself. I'm just as much as a victim as anyone else. You know, I mean, my crime's a little bit different, you know, but not a whole lot. You know, I just don't have the same type of professionals on me that these other people do. You can tell these people are, my people are either uneducated within the crime. They're probably very young. They have no, you know, collective education or, you know, logical sense of application, you know, to a progressive state of success for themselves at all. Where other victims, you know, that are on the conference calls, they are more than obvious they are victims of government crimes because they're former FBI agents, you know. I mean, they're former military leaders, you know. They're former DOD scientists, you know. I mean, so that shows me that there's an area of probability there that, you know, allows me to confirm that without a doubt they are a victim of government, you know, non-consensual illegal testing, you know, where there's other victims out there that are just, you know, victims of copycat crimes, kind of like myself. So.
Right. Wow. Okay. Now, is there anything else that you'd like to cover or delve into? I know one of our most interesting sessions that we did on the Awakened radio station was it dealt with the sexual violations because, you know, I know we should kind of tippy toe and we maybe shouldn't get into this, but this is a huge aspect. I mean, these people are into your complete privacy where in some cases, some people report the targeted individuals feel like their eyes actually become cameras where they're able to actually look through someone's vision and actually see their entire life, their entire house. They can describe stuff to them. They can attack people sexually. They can do all sorts of different things. So I know it's a taboo subject, but I think that we need to go there to let the public know what's at stake and what's really going on here, James. So can you kind of, you know, we opened Pandora's box, so can you kind of talk about that?
Sure, sure. You know, I mean, not a problem. But that's, yeah, the sexual violations, you know, were and still are 100% of my motivation, you know, factor on doing the radio shows, speaking out against, you know, the actual crime itself, you know, because even if you're a man, woman, or child, no one deserves to be, you know, peered upon, you know, and physically violated, you know, let alone that happening to them. But then to turn around and think that you have, you know, just the goal that they have to sexually attack these people, what would motivate, that's where my area of concern, you know, comes in and, you know, makes me, you know, naturally, you know, perform a psychological profile on the perpetrators themselves. You know, they're saying, oh, well, it's a program, oh, it's this, you know. Well, that just seems to be a nonchalant, you know, common excuse, you know. I mean, and I don't believe that. I believe these people are criminally disturbed, you know, to the point mentally where their objective is 100% sexually, you know, focused. It is motivated. It's driven to sexually abuse somebody. That's a narcissistic, you know, mental ailment that a person is suffering from, you know, and they're conducting these crimes onto children under the age of 10. Now, if you study sex crimes, if you know about sex crimes, there is an element of morbidity, which means it's a very morbid, you know, directive against children. Like if you were, you know, to abuse or to see a criminal case of the abuse of children that have been sexually abused under the age of 10, these are special cases for a reason. You know, it's not because they're, you know, 10 years old. It's because it is, you know, to the point of an adolescent state that has, you know, most, there's nothing to be sexually, you know, attracted to below that age. So, you know, past that age, there's a special area of morbidity that the actual, you know, criminal individual falls under, you know, and all the victims that I've spoken to, every single one of them, suffer from sexual abuses of some kind. There's always a sexual deviance, you know, that goes on, or a sexual state of rule, you know, or they'll try to put you in check or demean the actual victim. Dr. Robert Duncan covers it in a couple of his prior books about sexual attacks. It's basically used to break the victim so they give up and give in and just, you know, comply. So, which is something that you'll learn if you study, you know, a psychological abuse, you know, that has been, which is by proxy, it's a proxy state that children develop, you know, throughout their lives. If they've been sexually abused, there's only one or two ways that they'll turn out. They'll either become compliant and enjoy it and, unawarely enjoy it and not know that it's not, you know, a good thing, or they'll become very, you know, rebellious and, you know, and act outward against it and speak out against it and, you know, accuse everyone of it, very withdrawn and antisocial. So it affects the human psyche in, you know, one of two ways, you know. So that's exactly what they're trying to do. Either way that the victim turns out, it's still a very detrimental, you know, psychologically damaging result, you know, that was, you know, implemented under the, you know, criminal act of somebody else. So
right. I keep wondering what the payoff is for all this, because, you know, in my area of psychology, when I studied some classes on that, there's always a payoff for some pervert to do something. Like, what are they really getting out of this? I can't even get into that mindset. Like, what do they want to achieve with all this, you know?
Yeah, definitely, you know, I mean, narcissistic, you know, mental ailments, you know, or narcissistic, you know, psychological attributes, you know, they lead us, you know, they have taught us, you know, to understand that, you know, a narcissistic person that has, you know, that is clinically insane, and narcissism is a mental ailment, you know, and their main goal is control. They want control so bad that they will do anything to achieve it. You know, and they want control of, you know, everything in the person's life, the people that they meet, the beer that they drink, the cigarette they might smoke. You know, I mean, there is something that, there is an element of control all over the place. So it shows me that any and all of perpetrators, they are suffering from narcissism. It's a very narcissistic, you know, evil application that I definitely see. But the gratification that they get, because they get that attaboy on the back, you know, oh, well, you're big and strong, you know, oh, well, you're real tough because you, you know, controlled and sexually abused a six-year-old kid. You know, they're looking for, you know, the recognition that a person suffers, you know, with. They're looking for that hole to fulfill, because narcissism, people that are narcissistic seek that. That's what they want. They want the constant recognition of, oh, you're big and strong. Oh, well, you're so smart. You know, they're looking for that. And it's usually because they suffer from something, you know, that is probably very detrimental to their own, you know, personal psychological psyche, you know. I mean, so they, you know, could be suffering from, you know, small man syndrome, you know, which is, you know, where a really small guy just ain't near as big and tough as he really thinks he is, you know. So they'll suffer from that. So they'll, like, you know, cast out some type of verbal, you know, narcissistic comment to get the recognition. Constantly. All they want to do is feed their ego constantly. At least that's the only thing I can think of. I can't think of any other.
It's just hard
game
to imagine.
You know,
yeah, and I have trouble imagining somebody sitting in an office and this is their full time job. Like, how boring would that be, trying to sit there and program people or condition them every time they have a certain thought to give them pain or to do something to them, you know, shock the hell out of them, excuse me, you know. So it's like,
yeah.
who would actually take a position like that? I just don't get it. And I'm wondering, is this tied in with NSA? Is this CIA? Is this FBI? Who the heck is doing this, you know?
Yeah, there have been, you know, people in the past, you know, kind of like Dr. Cameron, you know, with MKUltra. You know, there wasn't really a whole lot of, you know, reasoning behind what he was doing. You know, I mean, who knows what, you know, motivated him to drug these people with LSD, non-consensually. These people had no idea what they were about to consume. So not only are they, you know, on LSD, but now they're strapped to a table and getting electrocuted while they're under the influence of LSD. Now, I don't know, but, man, that could be, you know, pretty concerning to the individual. But while, wow, what a thing to think about, man. I mean, what a morbid individual. What would make him want to do that to somebody, you know, or anybody, you know? I mean, but even under those, you know, exposures or those, you know, sick, morbid crimes, every time, Cynthia, every single time, every victim was sexually abused. They were brought to a point of, you know, sexual control. They would erase their memories. They would sexually violate them. They would lay them on the table naked. Who knows what was really going on behind closed doors, because we only have the written case studies. You know, so were these victims actually physically raped? You know, were they pimped out? You know, I mean, were there videos made that were being sold to some sick, you know, high-profile politicians? You know, I mean, you know, there was an area of concern that came out of the Pentagon of our own country. How shameful. 2,500 Pentagon officials got arrested for having accounts, current accounts, that were linked to child pornography websites.
Holy smoke.
Yeah, and they were viewing them from work. So that means that we have 2,500, you know, government officials that work at the Pentagon that are not only viewing child pornography while on the job. So that means that our American dollars are paying this guy to look at some little kid. You know, but they also have paid accounts, you know, that are actually, you know, delivering it to their work account, to their home account, to their PDA, you know, to their cell phones, you know. I mean, so that shows an area of, you know, of concern. They're sexually addicted to these children, you know. So they're flying out to the Philippines and flying out to Hong Kong and Vietnam and obtaining these children in a physical state to fulfill their sick fantasy. You know, I mean, so, and every single, you know, person, every single victim. So, yeah, I think that, you know, you've drawn a good point, you know, by bringing up the sexual, you know, motivation factor. In my opinion, it seems to be a very, very, very large motivated factor as far as, you know, what motivates the actual criminal themselves. That's what they're after.
James, this has been a riveting, you know, interview. Thank you so much for coming back on. I know you're in the middle of your invention and getting that finished, and thanks for taking the hour to explain this to us in a way that only you can explain it. Thank you so much, James.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great to talk with you, and we'll have you back on another time. Take care.
All righty, you too.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Always.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.